Sarnet, but we're going to be calling him Jerry because that's how he likes to be known. And he's got a book called Homeless Chronicles, From Abraham to Burning Man. I'm holding it in my hand. And Jerry, hello.
Hi, Dennis. Thanks for having me on.
I'm glad that you're here. I'll tell you that before I even read your poems, I was aware that you have worked with a lot of folks who aren't as fortunate as many of us are. And that interested me immensely. And I don't know, that got me to read your poems, actually.
Great.
So, why don't you tell us about yourself? That's a big open-ended question. Who the heck are you?
Actually, I spent a period of my life working in the Tri-County Santa Cruz area, setting up a prepaid Medicaid program in this area. It was a very interesting experience because it was well received in Santa Cruz, but very poorly received by the white shoe physicians in Monterey. They resisted it to the point of when I was young and naive, inviting me to a meeting of the American Medical Association where the president came, and they asked me to stand up, and I thought I was going to be given some prize, but instead they called me a communist.
Oh, my God. Honest to gosh.
For real.
And when you say the president, who do you mean?
The president of the AMA.
Uh-huh.
Who came from wherever he comes.
And so they pointed at you and said that you were a communist.
That's right. No applause.
Oh, my goodness. No one in the whole place took your side?
I think it was a self-selected group.
Uh-huh.
I probably deserved a little of it. I was.
It didn't deter you, though, did it?
Didn't at all. No. So I was born in St. Louis and raised on the south side of Chicago, which was a working-class neighborhood, and was the son of a man who was the first and only child born in this country. His brothers had been born in a shtetl in Poland. And years later, I realized that I had a classical immigrant family situation in the most positive sense, even though it wasn't a well-to-do area. When I revisited it during college, I couldn't get a taxi driver to take me in because of the gangs and the drugs. It wasn't like that when I was there. It was a lower middle-class Jewish immigrant neighborhood. And my father lived within a block of his older sister and older brother, and I had free rein with my little wagon to go among the different houses, and I collected old newspapers and 1 cent and 5 cent glass bottles, and then, unbelievable to my kids, actually sold them to the junk man who had a horse and wagon and he pulled it through the alley.
Mm-hmm.
We then moved to L.A., the promised land, and I went to grade school and high school there. And then I went east for college, came back west for medical school, east for more training, and finished up west again, and have really lived in San Francisco and L.A. areas ever since then.
When did you begin to do your work with homeless people?
After Harvard, Stanford education, instead of becoming a chief resident at Stanford, I decided to learn Spanish and take a job at the Elviso Clinic as the first board-certified internist they'd ever had. and I took care of a monolingual Spanish-speaking population who thought I was speaking Portuguese. But had this really marvelous experience. They were rural and Catholic, and they were really grateful for the care and very compliant. And that sort of set me on the path for a long time, taking jobs that nobody else would take. So I came back to those roots later on. When I lived in the Palo Alto area during the height of the tech bubble, when there was the greatest accumulation of wealth in the history of the world, that National Geographic's cover showed El Camino Real, which is the main drag, and on one side was richer than God Stanford University and the Stanford Shopping Center. And on the other side was this homeless squat camp. And that was their geographic lesson for the week. And I began volunteering at this homeless shelter. And for months, just swept and cleaned. It was after after a flood. But one day, one of the homeless clients who had earned a few bucks burning down poison oak weeds came in with an anaphylactic, a very, very bad allergic reaction. And he was about ready to die. And so not exactly Clark Kent going into the phone booth, but all of a sudden, I was a doctor, and I had my black bag, and he survived. And after that, I was outed. There was a real pleasure in not being the authority figure of a physician for a long time. But that sort of showed me that what I really should do was to develop a medical clinic for our patients. And so I did that for about 10 years. It ended up not only being the first words of this first book of mine, Homeless Chronicles, but the real inspiration for my poetry. The time that I spent at the homeless center was so extraordinarily valuable to me that I eventually began to write poetry about those amazing people that I met there. You know, not romanticizing it, but there, one of the chapters is titled Original People. And they were, you know, really an original group of people and a really civil society that would take care of itself. Lots of troubles, you know, with violence and mental illness and AIDS and substance abuse, but it was just a lovely experience. And
it was in the course of that that you came to poetry?
It was. In fact, maybe I'll read one of the that the central chapter of my book, although the shortest chapter, is the one about my homeless experiences.
Yeah, well, I think there are only three or four poems in
that's
there.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. But it was the stimulus, you know, for the book and the most tangible experience that I had that I wrote about.
Well, had you been reading poetry before writing it?
You know, embarrassingly, really not. Although in college I was an English major and the last thing on my mind was going to medical school. I was not a very, I was not a creative student in any way, and I didn't do particularly well in English, although I read a lot of it. I was the editor of the Harvard freshman paper, but I think that was mainly because nobody else wanted to do it. but, and I'm reasonably well read, but it was in school. I really did not have any inkling of either reading or certainly writing poetry, essentially, until I was 5 years ago when I was 60.
Well, why? Why? I think we all want to know how it was that poetry, if you'd never had a lot of experience surrounding yourself with it or reading it, did you all of a sudden want to write it? How did you know what it was?
I'm not sure, but the best I can reconstruct it, it was a combination of two major factors. That after I quit doing medicine and being a CMO and a chief executive officer for a living, I emptied out and really developed a very, very quiet life. And that one of the components of that was meditation. And once a year for about 10 years, I would go for a 10-day silent retreat up at Spirit Rock in Marin. And they were generally very difficult experiences at the beginning when the rubber hit the road of real-time life and all of a sudden, you know, you're silent and you're not looking at anybody. And during the first few days until I settled into it, you know, it would come pretty close to a psychotic reaction for a lot of people. And, you know, fortunately, the natural history of it was that after a couple days, it would become very mellow. And by the last 5 days, it would be literally ecstatic. But I found during the first retreats that it was very difficult for me not to write, which was one of the things you're not supposed to do. And what I found myself writing about was my homeless experiences. And particularly the first poem I ever wrote is called The Four Corners, which was sort of a riff on Eliot's four quartets. And it referred to the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, where across from the meditation center was Planned Parenthood. And across from Planned Parenthood, every Friday when I would go for a morning retreat, morning meditation, once a month, would be an anti-abortion truck with megaphones and huge, disgusting photographs of babies that had been aborted. And there would be essentially a war of sorts between the Planned Parenthood people trying to guide young women, usually of color, inside, in these redneck anti-abortionists who would say that Jesus will, you know, hate you and you will go to hell for what you're doing. And on the fourth corner was a halfway house for chronically mentally ill people who were pretty heavily medicated and sedated. And there was an affinity between the meditators during their walking meditations, quiet and slow, and the people sitting out on the stoop from the halfway house. We sort of befriended each other silently. And I would walk between this drama of the Planned Parenthood and their adversaries, and those four corners ended up becoming a poem.
Well, we've actually gone 15 minutes without a poem. How about introducing yourself further with a poem?
Sure. Why don't I read Four Corners? It's a bit long, but we've just discussed
it. That's okay.
It.
That's all right. Now, I have to remind you about George Carlin's seven words. I know that many of the poems contain some of them, and I'm embarrassed that we can't, that we have to censor ourselves on the air.
I'll try to do so.
All right.
So this is the Four Corners. Humankind cannot bear too much reality. From the Four Quartets by T.S. Eliot. Stanza 1, Burnt Babies. Sit, breathe, walk. Sit, breathe, walk, out and in. A day of no talk jangles my wits. Wakes me from spasms of jejune indifference. Last Thursday in June, I revisit old friends. Catty corner from our sangha, a flushed man camps out, mumbles to the Virgin, sipping more than coffee from his thermos. Below mug shots of Agnes Dei and mangled fetuses, a Madonna figurine pleads through placards, obey God's will or burn in hell. Death is your choice. Mother Mary, harsher than I imagine her son, Hector's bad science, infanticide causes breast cancer. 18 last Thursday of the months have passed since we met. He engaged at first, but now has quit, scowling behind sunglasses and ball cap. Camera trained cross the blacktop. Cameras trained cross the blacktop. Shoot each gothic doe loping the gauntlet to El Centro del Libertad. Another 60-ish fawn, blighted under mangy whispers, a bandanaed mosaic of Don Quixote and Prometheus, security on his fluorescent vest, tracks undisguised by elbow tattoos, mutters unholy trash to his ex-Mekong Express chopper crew, while ushering another deer to safety. I knew Mary before she was a virgin. Pope had excommunicated her, but she hauls in the megabucks. The fawn pauses to plead with her buck. Please stay clear of the hecklers, which he doesn't. 18 months ago, this guardian, sometime angel, suspected me. Palms forward, signaling no harm, I passed by. Today he grins. I scrutinize this diptych of two opposing pale dudes, both well past siring, as their chakras duel over a chocolate teen. One hedgehog protects, the other protests her right to choose. Out here in loud light, not shrouded by back alley coat hangers. I'm glad to be a physician, not the coroner. The bell tolls, heel to toe, I'm called back to the center. Stanza 2, Northeast Corner. Diagonal from Planned Parenthood looms La Selva, the jungle, a stark, frankly named halfway house, a bizarre menagerie strangled by slanted wild vine canopies. Piranhas and howlers, bowlers and sloths, of all sorts and age, untended, unpresent, absentee mind bodies, angular to the universe, mostly shrouded in grays and blacks, droop in morose lagoons, swoon under monsoon thickets, doze day mayors on the stoop. A few moles blindly seek asylum from the asylum. Their held-alized emptiness resonates with us slow walkers, breeds a strange acceptance, a twinge of kinship. But when they don't take pills in insane three times a day, these endangered creatures end up in my homeless clinic. Against protocol, once in a while I approach at my peril. Some bite and strike out like aroused sleeping animals. Today I contemplate speaking but don't. Attempt eye contact, fail. A foxy skirt sashays by, a split second of genital recognition. Yet to her we're all cuckoo, mental and patient, pitiable and wretched or invisible off the grid. Though sure I'm unseen, she scurries to the opposite sidewalk. A gimp ibis hunched over walker hobbles toward elder care. Will that hyena lurks near the entry snatch her purse? The bell tolls, toe to heel, I'm called back to the center. Stanza three, little sittings. Inside, rejoining circled pallid faces of the upper middle path, fanatics for love, extremists for peace, I exhale womb and tomb, work to let go original people. Outside seeps in, seeps from Planned Parenthood, seeps from mower whir struggling to bring order to La Selva, seeps from paramedic, maybe police sirens, seeps from motorcycle grind, bird twitter, pro-lifer guffaws, seeps as lowriders vibrate stained glass left over from a church. Though the congregation tired and died, the building sold, their souls still rattled the high beams, occasionally seep down. We lotus tripods rejoice in the spanking new place. I giggle at us practitioners of impermanence, mostly atheists, who worship Manet cathedrals much as Vipassana nowhere. Vipassana is a kind of Buddhist meditation. Yes, bricks and mortar appear quite enduring, a sutra of non-abdication. Our edifice complex? Is this cushion a cocoon to dodge life? An opiate to bypass the pain, my user's manual to decode emotion? Am I just a cross-legged droid running on batteries, programmed with devotion, avoidant, deluded, more humane than human? The bell tolls metaphysics away. Deep breath, I'm called back to the center. Stanza four, salvages. At day's end, Zafu in hand, Zafu is a meditation cushion, intimate yet detached, some moments seized, bursts of nirvana transparent as the window pane, others not, trapped by the screen, preparing to leave. I'm uneasy anticipating out there. The anesthetized stares, fogged in schizophrenics, odalesque blossoms already lost spring's bloom, shells of opaque seniors doing time down the block. A boyfriend turned family planning mediator and meditator peeks in the hall, greets me with a smile that kindles beatitudes of someone else's remembering. On the street, setting statues on grills while packing, two feckless evangelicals joke it up. Just say no's a lot like sex. It's good when it's good. It's good when it's not. Then screech off in a flash, burning rubber, their complex nomadic geometry onto a next wayward stop, tomorrow's last Friday of the month disgrace. Our four-corner gang will convene again in July. Out the door, squinty lamp shine comes on mothy, hungry ghost dogs, hungry ghosts are Buddhist images, dogs drawn to spectral sensibility, dim edge of town. The car radio blares an eerie bulletin. Eric Rudolph, the New Woman Clinic, an Atlantic Olympics bomber, a werewolf wrapped as a lamb of God, has been captured. I grit my teeth, inhale, stop for flowers on my way home to family and dinner.
As it didn't occur to me when I read this poem before that I remember now that Eric Rudolph was captured dumpster diving, which fits so perfectly into the poem.
Yes, you get it. Mm-hmm. You get it. So this is the first poem that I wrote.
Really?
Yeah.
My goodness. How long did it take you to write?
It took me, I thought it was finished the first day I wrote it, and I kept writing it until the day my final manuscript went to the printers.
Mm-hmm. You've got a poem in here about hanging out, apparently, at a workshop with Pinsky.
Yes.
How about reading that? I think that would...
Sure, that's a nice shorty.
Be perfect.
So, I wrote this after attending Robert Pinsky's colloquium at Stanford, which was the only poetry event I think I ever went to until I started reading poetry myself. Lyre to my ear, song more than meaning, perhaps lying to myself about passion, feeling not analyzing, shifting the metaphor, smitten. I wonder if Robert's words of wisdom do the hard clamation work of shaping, contouring lines to slant, slack, slam, so lyrics settle soft like butterflies, make sense when uttered out loud, shared awareness, not simply sharing, noodled just enough that fast food marinades into a spicy stew of vowels and consonants, rushing, rolling together with rich, fiery accents, burnishing the pyre. Other times, martyred a metric mitre, toning down tropes, mastering the minimal, are a syntax I can somehow muster.
Yeah. And probably we should explain that after the fourth line, you've got the dot, dot, dot. And is that a dot or a long dash on the penultimate line there?
It's a long dash.
Long dash. And then you ask the question. You finish the question. So the question would be, without the middle part, would be what?
Am I able to approach an ideal in which emotion and song and meaning blend together in a kind of simplicity that conducts itself through through images. And that's an ideal that I don't know if I will ever be able to achieve. But that's what I was hinting at in this piece.
Is that what you came away with after having heard Pinsky?
Half of it was what I came away with, and half of it was what I brought while I was listening to him.
Okay. Well, I have to tell you, I think it's quite amazing. And when we come back from our break, I'd like you to read the first poem in the book, in which you meditate upon what it's like to start a poetry career at this point in your life. But I have to say, I don't know anyone who waited that long, at least to. I mean, you didn't even dabble in poetry up until you started writing it.
Correct.
So I don't know any story like that. Period. It's amazing. But we're already just slightly past the halfway mark, so we're going to take a short musical break and then follow that with some announcements, and then we'll resume our conversation.
See you on the other side.
Yep.
If you listen to KUSP through your local cable TV system, we'd like to hear from you. A call from you will help KUSP claim our share of the copyright payments your cable system makes every year to the federal government. We'd like to know where you live, the name of your cable system, how long you've listened to us over the cable, and what programming on KUSP is valuable to you. Please phone our listener comment line toll-free at 1-888-549-6421 and leave us a message about your cable listening. Or visit our website at KUSP.org. KUSP's Sunday Night Jazz program is Giant Steps, hosted by Howard Feldstein. Giant Steps features music by John Coltrane, Thelonious Monk, and other giants of modern jazz, as well as contemporary jazz masters and new artists at the forefront of improvised music. Hear Giant Steps every Sunday night from 10 to midnight on Central Coast Public Radio KUSP.
All right, here we are. We're back on the Poetry Show. My name is Dennis Morton. My guest is Jerry Sarnett, and we're talking about his book, Homeless Chronicles. Before we resume our conversation with Jerry, I want to let you know that you were listening to a version of Haunted Heart by the very, very great Bill Evans. You heard the scratches on that music. It was originally on vinyl. Then I put it on tape, and then I transferred the tape to CD. So it's been through a few transmogrifications, and I apologize for the scratchiness. But what a great song it is. If you'd like to know what's going on in the Monterey Bay Area poetry world, go to www.poetrysantacruz.org. Len Anderson has put together an amazing website that's chock full of all kinds of information about what's happening in the area poetry-wise. And I do want to tell you that the second Tuesday of every month is reserved for a reading by Poetry Santa Cruz. And the next one is going to be featuring four local poets. Normally, we bring poets in from out of the area and team a visiting poet with a good local poet. But in the summer, we like to have one event where we feature nothing but local poets. And so the second Tuesday of August, we'll at Bookshop Santa Cruz, we'll feature four local poets: Marilyn Robertson, Joanna Martin, Tim Fitzmaurice, and Bert Glick, all fine poets. So now let's return to the Poetry Show. And Jerry, here we are. We're back. And, you know, I've got a couple of set questions that I ask all visiting poets, and I want to ask you these questions, too. One is the ABCs of... I realize that to ask you this question I've never asked anyone in your situation. I mean, you've been writing, what, 4 or 5 years now?
About five, yes.
About 5 years. So I'm going to ask you anyway, what is your advice to aspiring poets, ABCs?
Well, I really consider myself an aspiring poet.
Mm.
But what I've learned through my aspirations, I think that the most important thing, and what I'm still working on, is really trying to find my own voice. It really intersects with any kind of an authentic spiritual quest of trying to find out who you are. And that means rejecting the trendy. There's no question that I could benefit from some polishing, but what I've gained out of not being tutored is the ability to experiment and find my own voice.
How do you recognize your own voice?
there are many persona that I developed and put forth in the book, trying to imagine very different points of views about gender and about race and about religion, particularly around the Abrahamic tradition, in which there's so much violence, particularly between Muslim and Jewish Semitic brothers. What I've found is that there's a unifying theme about what I'm all about, though. And one of my first outside readers when I was putting the book together was not a poet himself. I chose somebody who knows me and is psychologically astute. And what he pointed out to me was what I couldn't articulate before then. He said, "Jer, you're clever and you can be really funny, but what you need to transmit to people is your redemptive quality. Instead of taking the cheap pratfalls, why don't you say what you really feel about people? Show your love and show your affection." And that doesn't mean not to be irreverent and not to be honest, but it didn't strike him as authentic. So, you know, that was really a sort of a nuance on finding my own voice. The one that I'm working on now is, although I don't have much sympathy with Pound's politics, he was a great editor, and the sort of less is more doctrine. And I don't know if I have that gear in me or not, but that's sort of my ideal now. I'm not sure I'll be able to reach it. That one of my teachers, you know, has said, "Make your weakness your strength." Phyllis Kestenbaum, who's a poet at Stanford,
her son's a poet too.
That's right. You know, said, "You write thick and you write really well, so don't try to change it. Just do it well and be yourself." So I haven't quite resolved that. I think that's all
right.
A new poet could offer.
All right. Well, I don't want to forget to ask you to read In Camera, because something you just said a few seconds ago reminded me of that poem in which you don't jettison either the feeling or the wise guy stuff occasionally.
Well, this is really a great opportunity. That
it's on page 83.
I've never had the luxury of reading The Four Corners publicly before, because it's so long. And this is a great opportunity to read a poem that I have also not read in public. So I guess that's another way of saying, pardon my stumbling. So it starts with a French quote, and I don't speak French. Do you?
No.
So it's something like,
struggling with English.
Les rapports sexuels n'existent pas. And you'll get the meaning as much as I've got it later. Does sexual intercourse exist? And it's from a fellow named Jacques-Marie-Émile Lacan. And each of these stanzas is ten lines long. And there's a certain repetition of words that you might find.
But look at the form, too. Say something about that
with
form.
With the word inside. So the form, the second, fourth, sixth, eighth, tenth, and twelfth lines of the stanza, each stanza are single words. What is it like inside? Somewhere you know well? Or are you a little shy? Cozy when you need a friend? A warm, moist place to avoid? Come closer, my love. It's all right. During this life, tight shots deep inside are a final room only neurosurgeons go. Oh, sure, PET scans can show interstices as monkey minds quicken or slow, and talking cures shrink week after week, year after cringing year. But what if I'm jabberwalking, naked, bald, fear, primal dread, who will live and who will die? Voices intruding really deep, nowhere to hide. Times only my beagle or barber dare be inside. My dear, isn't it just too bizarre, no matter how hard we try? Naps by the fire, skillet filmed with garlic and turnips, evening soup, bedding forever, closes lips and teeth. Still, you can't come inside my ADD head, or I penetrate your proscenium's veil till worms merge our sod long after we're frail, gone down the deep, deep well. Now, don't take this wrong. And in this 12-line stanza, the second, fourth, and all even lines are not only single-worded but parenthetical. I'm okay with us, mostly. We make rambunctious love sometimes. Do our best to share, often. Yet awesome as that is, frequently, we can't express, never, those travails cowering inside. So how do I get comfier beyond me, glue my gray, gooey glia, those are brain cells, onto yours, white matter giving rise to compassion, bonding four generations together. Deep, really, really deep inside, I tell and retell myself, forgive, simply because we're human. Stay limber. Release that bitter swill outside the inside. Be present. Pay attention. Everything's connected. Amazing grace, how sweet it is now and again. Unless, of course, intercourse does not exist.
Yeah. I at one point I knew very well why I liked that, but I can't remember what it was that I liked so much about it. I think I liked the ending, the last stanza, very, very much. It's preceded by some a kind of honesty that one may strive for, but doesn't always succeed in getting to. And
it's interesting because of the 70-some poems in the book, If you were to ask me the one poem I will never read in public, that would be it. Not because of the frankness, but because it's so complicated that I struggled to explain it, and the shape and the form of it can't be appreciated well by at least my reading.
Well, I don't think it... I think the shape and form may augment it when you have it in front of you, but I don't think it takes anything away from the poem just to hear it. My reading. Everyone brings his or her own sensitivity.
I'll let you argue that it was okay.
Jerry, we've got only 9 minutes left, and another question that I like to ask is who name three, four, five poets that you're enjoying right now and that you would recommend to our listeners.
I don't wander much from the great poets. I like Sylvia Plath a whole lot for her honesty and sensibilities. And I like Emily Dickinson a lot for her pithiness and really very modern style. And I like John Updike a lot. When I arrived at Harvard as a freshman, I was immediately intimidated when I was told that I would be sleeping in John Updike's bed. I was given his room. And the last thing in the world that occurred to me was to live up to that in a literary sense. But it's really a trip to enjoy his poetry now. Perhaps my favorite less known to Americans, a woman named Wisława Szymborska.
Uh-huh. Polish.
Yes, she's a Polish woman born in the 20s who experienced World War II and the Holocaust, although she wasn't Jewish, in an incredible way. And better than anybody I know represents the poetry that I would like to be able to write. Extremely simple and extremely vivid, with images that are just carried through these short, elegant pieces, and I can only imagine what they're like in Polish.
In an early poem in the book, I can't remember which one. Oh, I think it's the very first poem in the book, which you've got to read before we go off the air here. I think you mention Stevens and who else? I can't remember who else. Do you read Wallace Stevens?
I try. Uh-huh. I try. So this is from the first chapter of the book. It's the opening poem in a chapter called Suns Rise in the West, and it's called Beckoning. And in the it's written in triplets, and you'll hear the word altricial in the first triplet. It's the opposite of the word precocial that you'll hear. Beckoning. Thoroughly deranged by Rimbaud, quit tagging at 18. Were poles apart giraffes and groundhogs? He a genius, precocial, hatched full form. Me more accountant, past is sure, froggy, altricial. Still, Apothecary Keats and Doc Williams managed to be read. Kunitz succeeded Sophocles and Frost as the oldest working poet. peaked in his 90s. May Stan's word storm rust in peace. Healer, molt to anecdotalist at 62. Soup stewing back of the stove bubbles up chance memories. Only once in a while, chunks of reality drop in. Future problematic, address book tattered, thinned. More meditative present merges with wilier pasts. Divisions, time, truth, breakdown, ellipse, branch, bog and begin. Polonius, don't overreach as Wally Stevens' Mickey Mocker. After shaving, how are you tied to that jolly right man? Sing your stories out loud as the nascent troubadour I am.
I'm curious about quit tagging at 18. What's that? What is that reference?
I was trying to imagine Rimbaud today, sort of this irreverent,
okay, yeah. I should have gotten
anti-authoritarian
that.
Guy. He'd be a tagger.
Uh-huh.
He'd be doing graffiti on the freeways.
Yeah. And, of course, William Carlos Williams was, like you, a physician.
Right, right. And so this, I was trying to imagine myself as a troubadour, and that's why it's the Homeless Chronicles.
Well, I have to tell you, I just enjoyed the book very, very much. It took me a while to for my ear to accommodate itself to your voice, but once I did, and I knew I was going to. I knew it would. It's that way with many poets. To tell you the truth, you need to immerse yourself. You keep swimming around, and eventually you say, I got it. And then every poem opens up, and it happened with me. And I had a great time reading through this today, and I read hours and hours before today, but today was the piece de resistance when it all really opened up.
Thank you very much for the opportunity, and anybody that's interested can go to gerardsarnat.com to find out more about me and reviews and my reading schedule and my book.
We didn't mention the publisher. How are people going to get this book?
It's available on Amazon, and it's available through Pessoa Press. If you go to my website, both of them are linked onto it, gerardsarnat.com.
Okay. We've got a minute left, Jerry. Is there a really short poem that you could knock off in a minute and a half? I think we've got about a minute and a half here.
Lost in Translation. Plodding to the car after a late afternoon seminar, sated on Yehuda Amichai's poetics, multicultural illusion, intertextual repurposing, dehyphenated esoterica, my stomach growls. Dialing a chowmainery to go, ordering wonton soup with all the goodies, passing lovers holding hands, whispering Mandarin, ill at ease, I pause my cell before smoked tea duck.
Jerry Sarnat, thank you for being my guest on The Poetry Show.
My pleasure.
And thanks for listening, folks.